Hi everyone, it's Adam from Monkey Tennis here. Just saying a huge thank you to all of you that have supported my charity appeal so far. For those that haven't heard about it, this September I'm going to be swimming 15 kilometres between five islands in Cornwall. I'll be swimming the Isles of Scilly, that's Scilly, S-C-I-L-L-Y. I'm doing it because I want to, but also to raise money for CALM, the campaign against living miserably. It's a well-known statistic that 125 people in the UK die by suicide every week, and CALM run a free and confidential helpline for people to speak through their problems and ultimately to help prevent suicides. I'm looking to raise enough money to train two new phone workers to man those lines, and I'll be doing it by swimming the Isles of Scilly in Cornwall. If you're looking to support me, it would be greatly appreciated. You can donate at justgiving.com. Just go there and search for Adam Swim Scilly. That's Adam Swim Scilly, S-C-I-L-L-Y. All donations greatly appreciated. Thank you for helping me to support CALM. And now, on with Monkey Tennis.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
And this is the beauty of podcasting, the freedom of the medium.
Gokumpa.
Monkey tennis?
Bring, bring.
Fireworks. Don't muck about.
Trees are my pawn.
Monkey tennis?
Ready, steady, fuck off.
Scratch me!
Are you being served?
Monkey tennis?
Excuse me, your dog's taken my dog's stick.
With a chuckle, with a chuckle.
Monkey tennis?
Yup, absolutely. Yup, 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 absolutely.
Generally, I think new ideas are bad.
Monkey tennis?
Why not consider chips?
You must come and stay in the barn. Fuck off.
Riddle me that, you nutters. Nothing refreshes like an ice-cold glass of milk.
Nah.
Monkey tennis?
From the host house.
Keep it down, love.
Welcome back to Monkey Tennis, the Alan Partridge fan podcast. I'm Adam Brooks, and I'm joined by Tom Dark.
Beautiful.
Beautiful. Nick Holder.
Beautiful.
Beautiful. And Tom Stab.
Beautiful.
Beautiful. This is futile. So welcome to Monkey Tennis. Before we crack on with our in-depth study of From the Oast House, the Alan Partridge official podcast, we thought we'd just like to mark this very special occasion. Today is our 100th episode. Sweet
Woo-hoo!
Lord.
Hey!
Did anybody
there
think it would get
put
this far?
Put a party hat on for that.
Oh, everyone's got party hats. So well prepared.
Well, me and Tom have, because we saw each other yesterday, so we had the chance to organise it.
Oh, there you go. Nick and I are very much not in the party mood. Thank you so much for listening and rating and subscribing and getting involved in our quizzes and coming to our live shows. I mean, when we started this, genuinely, we thought we'd have a few hundred people listening, and it was just a bit of fun, and it's gone mad. And I think we've had 2 million listens now or something insane like that. So, just a huge thanks from all of us to all of you for listening. Here's to many more episodes for as long as there's Partridge.
I think my favourite thing. I think my favourite thing about that is I remember in the early days when one of our first reviews said at least there will only be 12 episodes of this and then they can go away, and now we're at 100.
Tough shit. Oh.
At
this point, for our listeners, Tom's attempted to deploy a confetti cannon and has failed to go off.
That is very annoying.
I'm so glad that we've screen recorded this so people can see that for themselves. Just how daft you look.
It's falling apart now. I genuinely wouldn't recommend letting that off. I let off one of those in my house once, and I was still picking up the confetti about 3 years later.
Yeah, well, luckily for me, it doesn't work, so that saved me any cleanup attempt.
A metaphor for the podcast itself. the promise of a huge explosion, and ultimately nothing happened. all right, let's get into the episodes then. So we're trawling our way through From the Oast House, and we're up to episode 4, which is tantalisingly titled Lynn's House.
Just to say, not only is the episode that we're covering in From the Oast House, but also this podcast itself is all about F-U-N fun.
The episode begins with an a cappella intro. Alan doing a little bit of singing, wondering to himself if perhaps that could be a single.
No.
No. Short answer, no. Also, I thought I noticed that as part of this, he was imagining himself on a plantation, which I thought was deeply inappropriate. He's basically co-opting the music of slavery for his own purposes, isn't he, here?
Yeah, I made a note there that obviously they recorded this in 2019. If they'd been recording this in 2020, would they have included that gag?
Well, this is they still could have edited it out.
And it's not the first time.
True.
It's not the first time that we've seen Alan talk about slaves and the ownership of slaves. Remember in Good Morning Matters where he talks about it being a tragedy that he probably would have been a slave owner rather than a slave himself. So he's got form in this area.
Indeed.
He does a thing where that he's done quite often before where he's reaching for the correct word for something and you sort of think that minutes later that he's forgotten about it, but then he hasn't. He can't let it go. So he's like a Spaniard man, like a Spanish man, a Spanish man. And then minutes later, when he's talking about something completely different, he just goes, Spaniard. you also hear a little bit about Alan's aspirations for stand-up. I thought this is one of those things where it's really Steve Coogan and the writers of Partridge speaking through Alan by him saying, gotta do stand-up, even if I just try it once. Because I expect in their line of work, they come across a lot of budding comedians and comedy writers that all think they could do stand-up, but crucially cannot.
I thought as well, the gag that precedes him saying he's got to do stand-up, it's not even good. It's just a play on words about Blue Ribboned and Red Letter Day saying it's a purple patch. It's like, if that's the level of what he thinks is good enough for stand-up, I think he would be quite shocked if he did give it a go.
He's really going to struggle. I feel like what I'd like to see, it made me think though, I would like to see Psychic Simon attempt stand-up, because I think he would also be bad, but I think that would be brilliant to watch. It'd basically be like the Digiwall, but in front of a live audience.
Keen.
Yeah, sounds good.
So Alan initially tries to make us guess what he's doing today. All he'll give away really is that it's of huge importance. Somebody guesses Antiques Roadshow. And he says no, but it's a good guess, as he adores stately homes and he loves watching hoarders being told that their tat is worthless, which is really good. And then someone else suggested browsing the dogs in Battersea Dogs Home, to which he said, browsing?
I think it seems reasonable.
Mm. Someone else suggested that he might be going to the demolition of a cooling tower, to which he says, I wish.
Yeah, also sitting in a Spitfire, historic battle reenactments, and standing in a butterfly house and letting the butterflies land all over you.
They're pretty good guesses. I could imagine Alan doing all of these.
Yeah, which ones from those lists would we rather do if you could choose one? Nick, I think it's safe to assume you're going to Battersea.
I'd browse the dogs at Battersea Dogs Home and want to take them all home.
Is this part of is this question sort of phrased in do you have to deliver an answer in the form of Nick's polling system where we're only allowed one option each, or
what with a ranking system of numbers that make no sense?
Yeah,
well, no,
yeah,
just we don't have time for that. Am I allowed to say the same as Nick?
Yeah, Nick. No. Basically, Stav wants to go to Battersea Dogs Home and he can't because it's already been chosen.
Exactly. All the dogs are
staggering. One visitor a day.
Nick's browsed up all the dogs and they've all gone home with him in the back of a transit.
Whether they like it or not. Stab, don't worry, you can still go and sit in a Spitfire for a day.
I think I'd go sit in a Spitfire.
See, I'd be quite up for the cooling tower demolition, personally.
I was going to take that.
Yes! Put in there quick.
What's even left now? Antiques Roadshow? All right, fine. I'll do that.
Adam, I could picture you doing some good historic battle reenactments. I think you'd be good at that.
I'll give it a go. I quite like, as you just said, all of these suggestions are quite appropriate for Alan. And I suppose that's because now, for the first time, he is hearing from people who are solely interested in him. So when you had people texting to the Digiwall on this time, it was your casual BBC One viewer. When you had people calling into North North Digital, it wasn't necessarily people that were Alan fans, it's just people that are listening to the radio. Whereas for this, you have to actually know him and kind of know a bit about him to get involved. So that's probably why they're all good guesses.
And why sometimes when he goes to Twitter, there's nothing there. Actually, that audience size is very small.
There's a recap on his date. Obviously, in last week's episode, we know he went full Lazenby and went on a date doing brunch and then swimming. He says he refuses to divulge too much because he wouldn't want to objectify her. But then he does say, looks 7, smile 5, personality 7.
Not bad.
an AP score of 19.
Alan Partridge score, yeah.
AP score.
It did very much remind me of, I think this is the second time I've mentioned it in this series, there's a similar scene in Men Behaving Badly where Tony is dating several women. He says, they're good girls, they've got their dignity. That's why I've come up with this ranking system.
We really need to do Men Behaving Podly, don't we?
Yeah.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah, we need to, at the very least, we just copyright the name, first of all. Men Behaving Podly, presented by Monkey Tennis.
So he's got his boat shoes on and his khakis on, which is something of a clue, but he realizes that he doesn't have his accreditation for the event that he's supposed to be going to, which prompts a call to Lynn. Obviously you don't hear Felicity Montague, she's not part of the series as far as I can tell, but there's a lovely bit where you just get his side of the phone call, and she is sort of absolutely oblivious to all the points he's making, all the kind of references. So he's like, ah, the Kraken awakes. What?
Yeah.
No, it's a giant squid. The RSPCA? No, it's made up. So somehow Lynn thinks there is genuinely a kraken on the loose, and the RSPCA needs to be called to rein it in.
Is a kraken a real creature? Isn't it just mythical as well? I'm not even sure it's a real thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's like it's a mythical giant squid, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah, but then yeah. Obviously
I think that is very much the
Lynn
joke.
Lynn believes in Jesus, who is also a mythical creature, so she's got form.
Oh, there you go.
don't anger the Baptists, Tom. Don't, let's not get bogged down in all that.
Only God can smite you. So Alan is off to, well, supposedly off to the Southampton International Boat Show. This is real. It's one of the largest in Europe and the biggest of its type in the UK, which Alan also says. And it was due to take place the 11th to the 20th of September this year in real life. So technically, if it did go ahead, it probably would have just happened by the time you hear this episode. Probably called off for COVID-related reasons.
I also have fond memories of the Southampton International Boat Show. As I remember the day that I went to university in Southampton, it was on and it was the talk of the town. So it really is a big event in the city of Southampton. I'm sure you've got fond memories of it. I didn't have any accreditation.
Fond memories of something that you didn't go to.
Yeah, basically.
So fond memories of people just talking about something.
Oh man, yeah. I have fond memories of the World Cup in 1966.
Did you go?
No, I wasn't alive.
But everyone was talking about it.
There's a nice bit where he's spelling out the name of the show as he reveals it. He gets all the way to the last four-letter word and then says, I don't have time to spell it all out. Having spelled out Southampton International and boat, he draws the line at also spelling show.
Yes.
And then, yes, we kind of hear on the back of his one side of the phone call that something's happened to Lynn. I felt genuine concern for Lynn at this point.
I think I feel genuine concern for Lynn most of the time that Alan is around her, to be fair. But yeah, Lynn's having heart palpitations and there's a scare and is taken to hospital.
Yeah, and as Alan says, he's like, we sort of hear him kind of get the details. He goes, I can't believe it. Yeah. I think I'm going to have to miss the Southampton International Boat Show. No concern for Lynn, really.
That's the thing, you hear him on the call saying, like asking Lynn if she's all right, but when he hangs up, he actually sounds annoyed. And then when he's saying, he keeps kind of repeating to himself, Lynn's health must come first. Essentially, he's trying to convince himself that's correct, isn't he?
Yeah.
I mean, I took from it the classic Alan where he's kind of, obviously he's, quote-unquote broadcasting, he's recording a podcast, so he would want his audience to think that he was concerned for Lynn's well-being. But if the recording wasn't happening, would he have had that same reaction? Possibly not. It's classic Alan that we've seen over the years where he sort of feigns concern for other people, where actually it's like, how is this impacting on me?
And even as even in his concern, he is trying to kind of find ways to downplay Lynn's ailment. So he gives lots of examples of occasions where we've all had heart palpitations. For example, getting into a hot bath too fast, having an ice cream, or a lovely little know me, know you callback here, bumping into the relatives of a man you shot to death accidentally. So he's obviously come across Forbes McAllister's relatives, perhaps at an inquest or just on the street.
Yeah, I missed the Forbes thing on my first listen. I thought it was it not the hot bath is combined with it's after an ice cream? I thought those two things were together in causing heart palpitations.
I don't think I've ever done that.
No.
Keen to try it. I like ice cream and I like baths. So
yeah, but just don't get in too fast because that is where you will risk the heart palpitations. You've got to do it slowly.
Nick, you wouldn't be a fan of that because you hate baths, that's right.
Unless ill.
I don't hate a bath, but I'll only have a bath when I'm feeling poorly. If you're very ill, then you're probably stuck in bed. But when you're at that kind of poorly level where you're just not feeling right, a lovely bath can be not only a relaxant, but can also help with your ailment.
So you've just said a lovely bath. So inherently baths are lovely. Oh, lovely. So why not treat yourself to one where you're feeling tip top?
Yeah, I just think I'd rather have a shower, get it over and done with.
So you know,
the confused world of Nick Alder.
Yeah, basically, Nick, you could be feeling on a 9 out of 10, have a bath, and you're 10 out of 10, but you're not interested.
But I think sometimes a bath, it's too relaxing, so you wouldn't want a bath before you
too go
to...
relaxing.
Too yeah, relaxing. It's
too so relaxing. Have one before bed. It's the optimum time. Have one in the evening. Lovely. Candles, bit of music, Netflix.
Yeah,
hardcore pornography, one of those.
I definitely think if you're not in a great state, then yeah, it's the iPad, some really nice bubble baths, some candles, a deep bath, and relax yourself better.
Nick's deep bath.
Sponsored by Dettol.
Or hardcore porn.
So there's a bit of chat about Lynn being mildly racist, but yep. in Alan's explanation of her racism, he also exposes his own. They had a foreign doctor called Dr. Robert, and he's saying how great it is that Dr. Robert got out of Rwanda before the genocide. So, you know, they're both racist. It's just Lynn sort of a little bit more honest about hers. He describes her as a race/Baptist, which I thought was quite nice.
I think it's fair to assume she's picked up these racist views from her mother as well.
Yes.
Well and, ingrained.
Some great bits about her capacity for drinking, which I don't think has ever really come up before, that she drinks steadily, not heavily. And to quote Alan, he says, she drives like she's drunk anyway. The police know her, but they don't pull her over. She's hiding in plain sight like Jimmy Savile.
So good, that
a
bit.
A lovely quote.
Brilliant.
Also a great bit that it turns out that the cause of her palpitations is likely stress. Alan has no
stress.
Alan has no concept of the stress that he puts her under.
I think he feels aggrieved at that point, doesn't he? He thinks that he's the one that should be suffering from stress. He's the one that should be in hospital.
He's
the one that carries the burden of being a public figure. So he's mortified that Lynn could possibly be stressed when we all know as listeners that being Alan's tireless PA must be one of the most stressful jobs going.
So the only thing he can come up with that he reckons that any stress on Lynn's part has been caused by her nephew getting into chemsex.
Yep.
Nothing to do with Alan's demands of as her employer or not letting her take bank holidays off because he's not a bank and neither is she.
Also, that's right, I love that. Also, crucially, Lynn's nephew's got into chemsex, but Alan's been sworn to secrecy, he says, as he reads it out on his podcast.
Yeah.
Yep.
It's very much Domingo in Little Oakley, isn't it?
Speaking about him not giving her bank holidays off because neither of them is a bank, he then also says that he judges her requests for time off on their merits, but he names two examples that are essentially exactly the same. He grants the first one, but he doesn't grant the second.
And this is, again, from the kind of, you know, same benefits package as flexi grief, where you can't take a prolonged amount of time off. It has to be taken in bite-sized chunks. another baffling example of how Alan deals with any kind of time off.
I'm working on the basis that Alan would grant a visit to Bewley Motor Museum because he would like to go there himself, because obviously he's into motoring, whereas at Chelsea Flower Show, he's not interested, so that gets a no.
And so as a result of this time off with palpitations, he's Lynn-less for the next week, but he doesn't need a temporary assistant, couldn't possibly go a whole week just sailing by on his own. So he wrote to Admin Pixies. I like the fact that he's styled this job ad as if it's a Lonely Hearts. Sort of like, I can't remember the exact words, but it's kind of, you know, like broadcasting employer seeks, you know, like good sense of humour kind of thing. Yeah,
no kids.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose in Alan's world, he probably hasn't had to write a job description or sort of advertise for a job for years, whereas he is frequently involved in the world of dating, so is much more familiar with the format of a Lonely Hearts ad.
I was just going to say about him being Lynn-less for a week. One of my favourite lines in this episode, he says, "I'm going commando, Lynn-wise." Slightly harrowing image almost.
Yeah.
His requirements for the temporary assistant: they must have no children, and they need to not be too sassy, but some sass is allowed. I guess that kind of reminded me of his relationship with Psychic Simon. You know, like, he can make a couple of jokes at Alan's expense, but once it goes too far, he's cut off very quickly. He left a typo in the ad to see if anyone can spot it. Only the people that do will progress. And he added hashtag me too at the bottom just to show what side of the Weinstein fence he's on. And then he adds hashtag time's up just to be sure. Although he does say that he prefers to avoid women in trousers.
And don't forget that the next round is problem solving.
Yeah, I like the idea. It's kind of like the Krypton factor, isn't it? Just to spend a week working with Alan, probably on £10 an hour. You've got to, you know, there's probably multiple rounds that you need to kind of get through. After problem solving, I can imagine there's a physical assault course, and after that, you probably have to land a flight simulator.
Did you make a note of the examples of the industry power that Alan says that he holds?
Oh yeah, this is brilliant. But if you've got it,
there were two things that he could either get tickets to the final of Strictly or arrange a meeting with Simon Mayo. That's power.
That's power. So he pops around to Lynn's house, the titular Lynn's house of the episode, to get his accreditation. Along this point, he says, "I love boats. They're like the cars of the sea," which seemed like an odd thing to say and probably one of the weakest lines of the series so far. There's a nice hint here, I thought, that he is outflanked by Lynn in terms of physical strength, because she's left the keys under a cement dog and he struggles to lift it. Presumably she must have lifted it to put them there. So I think she could have him in a fight.
There was also a nice kind of like dig at Lynn as well. He says, "While she's off doing sweet FA, I'm off employing a sweet PA." I just thought, not only is that a great bit of writing, but a nice little dig at Alan, insinuating that Lynn's just having a rest essentially in hospital and not doing anything.
And talking about the writing, I quite like that line about boats being the cars of the sea, because it's kind of silly and doesn't really make sense. And it's just Alan trying to make everything like motoring and trying to align it with that's why he likes going to boat shows. I thought that was quite good personally.
Okay, I suppose. So my notes next, I've just got with three exclamation marks. We're inside Lynn's house. So exciting. Which is a perfectly serviceable dormer bungalow, Alan says. A two-story bungalow, so not a bungalow.
Yeah.
And we learned he's never been there on his own before, which is, I mean, might seem quite unremarkable, but I mean, she's been working for him for the best part of 20 years now, so the idea that he's never been to her house before is quite shocking.
Well, it sounds
like 30 years, isn't it?
I mean, it seems like he's been in a couple of times, and he lists a few examples. So, you know, if she's left her prayer book in the car, he might come back in and give it to her and say, "Please don't do it again," or "Pop the kettle on so I can use the toilet without being heard," or "Have you heard so-and-so's into little boys?" But he's had what he describes as quite, you know, trivial moments in the house, despite the fact that some of those things probably don't require much time in the house versus so-and-so's into little boys, which is probably a bigger discussion that you don't want to have just for a couple of minutes while you pop in for a cup of tea.
Yeah, he definitely has been to the house before, because there's the bit where I forget what the exact phrasing is, but Lynn kind of blocks him from going into that room where he discovers what he discovers when we talk about it later on. But he mentions in the recording that, Lynn often tries to block or get in his way when he goes towards that door. So he has been there before.
Mm-hmm. And also, I mean, I guess that ties back to the cement dog with the keys underneath it, that she probably could stop him from going in if it came to blows.
Yeah.
I like those excuses you just mentioned. The reasons you just mentioned, Nick, for him going round, sort of to tip her off that someone they know turns out into little boys, highlights something that's run through the whole of Lynn and Alan's relationship, which is, I think, they seem to get their most joy together at sort of gossiping about other people's misfortune. So like you see it when they discover that Tony Hares is dead, you see it when got a message with you see it with some of the relationship with Chris Feather, you see it now with him, you know, him coming around kind of, I get the impression that they like to update each other on this, on other people's downfalls, and that's kind of one thing they have got in common.
I think downfalls is exactly it, and I think it's a very interesting point, this, because it does show, no matter how fractious their working relationship actually might be, when it comes to essentially the downfall of one of Alan's inverted commas enemies, Lynn is always going to be supportive of that.
And also in I'm Alan Partridge series 2, whenever they gang up together to get one over on Sonia in some way, so whether that's throwing the fake beard out of the car window, out of the sunroof, or when they talk to each other really quickly so she can't understand, and he's like, "Oh, that's very good." So there are those little nuggets of times when they kind of come together, which I always really enjoy when they kind of, when they're in sync.
A team, yeah.
Mm. Yes,
it sort of bleeds through into what Alan says next as well, about that Lynn isn't the sort of person to kind of pounce on you. She prefers to wear away at you until you presumably leave the area. So I think that ties together quite nicely with this sort of, you know, just kind of having subtle digs and just being difficult until eventually you just have to give up and go. He has a little nudge around our house. I feel like the writers know that this is what we want from an episode called Lynn's House, is we want to know about the furnishings, we want to know about the decor, we want to know like what's lying around. So he picks up a book, which he assumes is going to be something frothy and lightweight, and then he finds out that it's actually the Ipcress file, and so he assumes she must be reading it to impress a man.
I love that. I feel like that ties in quite well to when in episode 2, when he was having a nose around the person's house and kind of like casting huge kind of aspersions around the type of character based on the books that were on the bookshelf.
Yeah, and assuming that all the frothy stuff was the guy's like ex-wife that had left him, and all the serious stuff belonged to the man of the house.
So, you know, he can't get his head around the fact that Lynn would be reading a spy novel, basically. He can't believe there's any way that she would read that for her own enjoyment.
She can't be interested in it. She must be trying to impress a man. Yeah. That's the only reason why she could be reading it.
And equally, furthermore, does that mean, because essentially that would impress Alan?
I feel like Len Dayton is very much from his wheelhouse, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely.
She has a Freeview box that's not plugged in. And she has a Stanner chair. Well, he calls it a chairlift. It's a stairlift, isn't it? I think it'll be from when her mum used to be with her. So Alan obviously has to have a go on it. I quite like this bit because he's...
I would definitely do that as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, for sure. I like that he sort of reviews it on the podcast as if he's on Top Gear as well. Let's open her up and see what she can do. That was a lot of fun.
Has anyone tried a stairlift?
No,
I haven't either. Keen to.
She has a penchant for, I love this description, austere post-war biscuits, custard creams, bourbons and ginger nuts, which I think that's a kind of, it's quite relatable. There's a lot of people who that's their type of biscuit, isn't it?
That's exactly what I was going to say. I'm very much from the austere, dry biscuit. So my only biscuit that I'll ever buy or ever eat is a plain digestive. Delicious.
Let's unpack this.
Wouldn't even add a layer of chocolate.
Nope. Don't need it. Don't want it.
Are you saying no to a hobnob if offered?
Not if offered. So I will eat other biscuits, but just to be clear, I buy pretty much every week one pack
that's
of plain digestive biscuits.
So dry.
Really? So that's part of your weekly shop? Staggering.
Yeah.
That's just like eating dust.
Delicious, delicious dust. It's not too sweet. I generally have sometimes one at lunch, and I'll have two in the evening with a herbal tea.
Why not enjoy the Nick lifestyle by having a plain digestive whilst fastidiously avoiding a bath?
So my question was going to be, which out of those three is everyone's favourite?
I'd take a bourbon if pushed. But I'm not really a fan of any of them. They all feel very chalky and not much like a treat in the year of our Lord 2020.
I'd be torn between a custard cream or a ginger nut, to be honest.
I think it's a custard cream for me. Custard cream.
Yeah, I think it would be custard cream.
Or maybe hack the custard cream, where you take a couple apart, combine the creamy filling, so you've got like biscuit, maybe two or three layers of cream filling, biscuit.
Why not put a ginger nut in the middle of it as well?
Oh, you know what, Tom? Let's go crazy. Why not? Why not indeed?
I can imagine eating that in the bath.
Cream is misleading, though. I think it's more custard dust, isn't it?
It's definitely compressed custard dust, without a doubt.
It's custard. It's custard chalk.
Yeah. I was also quite surprised that there was no mention of rich tea or Garibaldi's in Lynn's joyless biscuit selection. I thought those would have slotted right in.
I feel like Garibaldi, as far as the writers are concerned, is too obviously funny to be included. The word Garibaldi is in and of itself funny, whereas custard cream is
more
subtle. Yeah. So he goes into a room he's never seen before, because as we mentioned, Lynn usually stands between him and the door, and then all capitals in my notes with an exclamation mark, Lynn paints.
She paints.
I think I'm kind of relieved, and I'm glad that she has a creative outlook where she can, you know, get it down on the canvas, because she probably doesn't have someone that she can talk to. So this is her kind of creative outlet to take all the things that are troubling her mind and get it down on the canvas.
Now, at this point, was anyone expecting, because I know I was, there to be a painting of Alan?
Yeah, I thought it was going to be kind of representing her sort of dislike or resentment of Alan in painting form. But no, it seems like they're all just largely religious.
Yeah.
I did kind of think that the painting of Alan would have been really funny, but it, as we've kind of often said before, they don't always take the obvious route, and I think that would have been the obvious route, and I like that we won't cover it, we'll come to it. There is a discovery that Alan makes, which I think is a better execution of a hidden thing in Lynn's house, rather than just, it's a painting of me, which, don't get me wrong, would have been funny, but I think the route they take is better.
You've also got the problem of how they would reveal it if she had done a negative painting of Alan, because all we hear is through the conduit of Alan, so if he saw that, he probably wouldn't then explain it to the podcast, and so it wouldn't really ring true.
Yeah, I feel like that would probably only really work as a visual gag. So if it was in a TV show, I think there would be quite good ways you could reveal that and have Alan react to it. But yeah, in an audio form, I think that'd be quite tough. But I wasn't surprised that they went with the religious route, because I mean I assumed the man on the hill with the sun setting behind him is Jesus, and of course you've also got
could be Moses.
You've got rays of sun behind a dove titled Holy Ghost as well.
Some nice quotes from Alan about these paintings. His head's too big for his body, but it's very poignant. And crucially, I don't think a man would paint these. I think it's at this point that Julie enters the scene, isn't it? Lynn's neighbour, primarily to complain that Alan's parked across her driveway, and there's a lovely bit of pedantry here, which again I imagine might be the writers or Coogan spilling into Alan, he's perplexed that she's complaining he's parked across her driveway, but she doesn't have a car, so what's he blocking?
I like that Alan can't see that this would probably be the worst thing that you could possibly do to him, block his car in and block his drive, yet when he does it to someone else, purely because they don't have a car, that means that, you know, it shouldn't trouble them and it shouldn't be a problem.
I'm almost on Alan's side. He handles it badly, don't get me wrong, because he's Alan, but also, she hasn't got a car, so what's he doing? What's the problem?
And actually,
I'll be thinking that internally, probably, while saying I'm really sorry.
If he'd handled it in a better way, in terms of, I'm here because it's an emergency situation and Lynn's in hospital, I didn't have time to check, if there was another if there was another car that would be coming in, I think it would be fine. But yeah, but obviously, he handles it badly and is, in effect, completely rude to the neighbour because she doesn't know who he is.
Yeah.
So he's immediately pissed off by that.
Crucially, I'm also on Alan's side because I think I've got a similar real life parking issue with a neighbour at the moment, and I think that Alan would agree with me in my case, so I have to side with him on this as well. I like this. There's a bit where I feel like Alan's almost very close to having an epiphany about his behaviour and the way he treats Lynn with this whole Mr. Kipling thing, where he basically is talking to Julie and it's revealed that Lynn thought that Mr. Kipling was a genuine, kindly gentleman that is
a debonair gent at a garden party.
Yes, the proprietor of a delicious cake company, and Alan's had to say, you know, this is a fictitious character made up by a marketing department. And then Julie says to him, well, why did you have to say that? And he's sort of like, well, what do you mean? He's like, well, you know, why did you have to burst the bubble? And for a second, I think he's really about to latch onto something, you know, like a bit of a therapy breakthrough. He goes, oh, I've never really thought about it like that. And I was waiting for the kind of, oh, yeah, you know, perhaps I've misjudged. But he's like, I've never really thought about that. And I probably won't think about it again once I've stopped talking to you.
I think that there's another moment towards the end of this episode where, yeah, you think he's going to have a bit of a moment of levity and a bit of a revelation, but it doesn't come. Did you guys notice when he's saying he's there to pick up Lynn's Kobo? Had you heard of a Kobo before?
Yeah.
Yes.
Because it's a type of e-reader.
Yeah. So of course he explains it in the episode. But I thought that was kind of funny because he then says, "Oh, you might know it as a Kindle." It's a bit like, okay, interesting, almost like semi product placement for Amazon. But the fact that Lynn has a Kobo, so not the Amazon device, was quite a nice little kind of subtle up yours to Amazon.
I read it more that, you know, normal people that know what they're doing get Kindles, and that Lynn, a baffled woman in her late, 70s, has bought a Kobo because it's basically, as far as I know, Kobos were aggressively marketed by W.H. Smith, and that's where I'd heard of them. So she is a W.H. Smith kind of girl, and most people are Amazon shoppers who bought Kindles. Yeah.
But either way, great product placement.
Yeah,
cheers,
well included. There's a bit where he's talking about, I don't know if it's at the boat show, he's expecting Ellen MacArthur to be there and he's looking forward to seeing her so he can say great sailing, kiddo, which I thought was one of the most patronising things I've ever heard. I mean, has he ever even sailed a boat? And also very indicative that his views haven't changed since he was a sports reporter, and essentially he was massively impressed by the sporting prowess of all the male sports people he spoke to, and then he basically just fancied all the female ones.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Is it time for the revelation vis-a-vis Alan's complaint letters?
I think it probably is.
So he finds out that Lynn has stored, but crucially not sent, probably, I think, hundreds of letters of complaint.
Definitely
that Alan's
hundreds.
Written to people over the years. Did anybody note down who some of these letters were to and what they were about?
Yeah, I've got that, if you want me to go through it. I like the way it starts off with why is Lynn writing to Kay Burley? So it takes them a while to process the fact it's actually his letter. So you've got Kay Burley, you've got Ainsley Harriet with the brilliant line, ready, steady, fuck off. you've got the BBC Canteen and Sue Cook when he wrote her drunk in 1995 making a proposition. I think those were the main ones.
I think it's important to go through the reasons that he's complaining. In the case of Kate Burley, it's because she didn't wave back across the room from a Pizza Express. Ainsley Harriet, it's because he wasn't invited to Ainsley Harriet's summer garden party. BBC Catering, it's because he mistook cling film on a ready meal for a condom, removed it and ate the meal anyway. So crucially, he is prepared to eat a meal that he believes has a condom.
And he thought it was a used condom as well, which is even worse.
And Sue Cook, crucially, he wrote to her when he was drunk in 1995 asking to have a relationship.
Yeah. I think there's also the Lord Mayor of Norwich who took the equivalent of a binman's salary to get a hair transplant.
threatens to sort of blackmail him, doesn't he?
Yeah.
But I thought this was quite interesting. Did anyone else expect this to be the point where Alan turns on Lynn? He's very angry that she hasn't supported. But actually, he's matured a little, perhaps.
Well, I also think he's kind of guided or navigated through the correct way to think by Julie. So she's like, oh,
yes,
she saved you there. And then that's the point where Alan's like, yeah, she has. Whereas I feel like if she hadn't been there, he probably would have flown off the handle and gone, what the hell's happened here? Why haven't you done this? But he's kind of like navigated with the correct way to think about this.
He's had to be instructed how to think. So
it's exactly the same thing that happens with Mr. Kipling, isn't it? The neighbour kind of forces him to realise there is a different way to think about these things.
And so he says, oh yeah, she was protecting me from me, and then he sort of it kind of builds to the point where you feel like he wants to do something nice for her, but what it turns out that is that he gets Julie to buy a card from him. He gives her some cakes that belong to her anyway. He's suddenly so touched that he's prepared to ask someone he's just met to buy her a card on his behalf.
And there's a really great moment where it sounds like he's going to give her a lift and drive her to the hospital, which would obviously be, you know, the right thing to do, irrespective of this discovery. Just maybe give her a lift if it's just down the road. But no. She's getting the bus and he's like, oh, great. Like, there's no offer of a lift.
And then finally calls her Judy instead of Julie.
Yes.
And that's the end of the episode.
So good. I think that whole sequence is so fantastically done because, yeah, you think it's going to go one way and takes quite a severe left turn. Yeah.
So, anything else on Lynn's house, or should we move on to episode 5?
I was going to say, I just like this kind of the solidifying of the Gibbons world, like we talked about Alan's love of swimming the other week, like his regular trips to the boat show. So these have obviously been referenced in the I Partridge book and Mid-Morning Matters. And in those versions, it's the Earl's Court boat show, and it looks like he would regularly attend with Dale Winton, Paul O'Grady and Noel Edmonds. So I just think that's quite nice that that's clearly they developed the character to a point where that's something that he does every year.
Lovely stuff. So episode 5 is titled AMA for regular Reddit users or people of an internet era. You'll already know what this is. Effectively, it's Partridge fielding listeners' questions, although we could get into some debate about how many questions he actually manages to get through in this 22-ish minute episode. I think it's maybe four.
You know what? It's actually six. So should we recap those at the end of the ep?
Yep, sure. Okay. Yep. So he gives some examples. He's had a soundscape made, which is basically just some audio layered over some other audio. What was your earliest memory? When did you last cry? Would you bring back hanging? How does Alan celebrate Ramadan? And how do you take your eggs? To which the answers respectively are looking at a kite, when I lost my best scarf, yes, by eating poppadoms at home, which is my favourite, and coddled for eggs.
I didn't know what coddled eggs meant. I had to look that up.
Yeah, I looked it up as well. It sounds disgusting.
To be honest,
eggs. That's your favourite.
No, it's not. It's not. It's when you...
No.
I've got to stop you there. It's when you take an egg just to the point of being cooked. So a poached egg would be a cooked egg. A coddled egg is like just on the cusp of being cooked, which sounds gross. Always makes
so
it
So it's basically a raw poached egg.
Yeah, essentially. I loved the idea that he felt you could give a one-word answer to would you bring back public hanging? Just yes, there's no further detail required. and then the idea of celebrating Ramadan where it's just eating poppadoms at home, which no doubt would be on his own, but also there's no further detail on a meal or it's part of a wider setting or you're with friends. It's just eating poppadoms, which is generally speaking as part of an Indian meal, just the first part of a much bigger meal.
It sounds to me like effectively he's just Ramadan to him is an excuse to eat poppadoms, isn't it? That's all it means. That's all it means as far as Alan's concerned.
Also, it really sounds like he says Ramadan instead of Ramadan.
Quite possibly.
I think he definitely says Ramadan.
So this soundscape that we heard was edited by Tony Meber, and apparently it's very important that we talk about
Toby Meber.
Yes, yes.
Sorry, Toby Meber.
Very important to discuss at length how this very basic bit of audio technology was put together. So he's the son of voiceover artist John Meber. Alan seems to think that a soundscape is basically a revolutionary new idea, but I'm pretty sure this was happening, 50 years ago.
Yeah, I did know he takes around 2 minutes to explain this soundscape that lasted for probably 15 seconds.
Yeah.
And that he thinks didn't work anyway.
Oh, yeah, that's amazing. He goes from saying he did a fine job and praising him as having real passion to the concept was a bit confusing, it didn't quite work, I won't be doing it again, and generally I think new ideas are bad.
I did enjoy the kind of relationship that these two had. I also enjoyed that Alan had to ball him out a couple of times and said that his dad would be ashamed of him, which... doesn't get much worse in terms of an insult, so it's gone well.
And that becomes so much worse when you refer back to episode one, when he advertises that Toby Meber is doing his debut gig at the Fob and Firkin, and he says he's not a confident lad.
Not anymore.
I wonder why.
So
Alan's introducing this as the first in a regular strand. I mean, saying that has become a regular strand across the APU, yeah. Of AMA or Ask Me Anything. We discover that he has previously discharged himself twice from hospital, once because of the infected foot in Nomad, which I thought was good because it does indicate that the events of Nomad did actually take place and it wasn't just a fever dream where he met a tramp. And he also says, yeah, this is really nice because I think one thing you can miss from audio Partridge is that sense of slapstick that you sometimes get from the TV. But I think the description of him having an ECG exam where the nurse took too long to put the sticky patches on him, chatted about Dermot O'Leary for too long, so he went to leave, but the patches pulled the equipment trolley behind him, was a nice bit of slapstick, even in the description of it.
Mm.
I thought it was interesting, the reference to discharging himself in the Nomad context, because he, in this version here, is talking about a Falklands veteran who was diminishing Alan's own suffering. But I think in the reality of the Nomad book, he basically discharged himself because he had to get back to a broadcast at Northern Norfolk Digital because he didn't have the holiday time.
In terms of AMA as a format, have any of you guys sort of taken part in one or watched one sort of unfold?
No.
Yeah. I've seen some great and some terrible ones before.
I highly recommend, I won't necessarily go into too much detail here, but some ones for you to check out in your own time. Definitely check out the James Corden AMA and definitely check out the Woody Harrelson AMA because they both go very badly.
Is that the Woody Harrelson Brampart one?
Yeah.
Incredible.
So good.
Yeah. Please do search for that.
I was going to say, I like the way that Alan tease up the explanation of AMA at the top of this, because when he's saying a social media device in which a celebrity sits at a computer and people in offices ask them burning questions, I like the fact there's a level of disdain when Alan's describing trends or practices on social media. He's scathing and kind of unsure of the value. And I'd say arguably, I think you could look that this is the writing team using Alan as a mouthpiece for their own views again.
Yep, absolutely.
Yeah, they've probably been asked to do AMAs loads of times and said no.
I've certainly never seen Steve Coogan do an AMA, and I'm sure there have been plenty of projects where it might have made sense for him to do so.
And also, I realised on a previous episode, we were talking about the Alan the official Alan Partridge Twitter account, which kind of comes into life every now and then when there's a new project. And in a previous episode, we talked about there was a tweet from September 2019 where Alan was saying, I receive up to questions from fans wanting to know about the real me, and even though that's true, I'm nonetheless soliciting additional questions from you. They will either be used in an exciting forthcoming project, if any, or more likely discarded. So, Adam, you did predict that was going to be a potential call-out for questions to be used in a new project.
Yeah.
So whether any of the responses in that were actually used on this, I don't know, but probably not, because as we'll go through, he doesn't really answer any decent questions.
I've got a feeling that although they asked for it, I don't think they were ever intending to use questions from real people, but I think they put that tweet up so that now when you go back, it's like,
he did really ask for them.
Our housewife's favourite, Nick Knowles, re-enters the frame at this point when Alan talks about previous AMAs that Nick Knowles was accused of avoiding any touchy questions, e.g. did he kill a man in a pub fight in 2000, or Richard Hammond, who didn't want to answer whether he had lifts in his shoes and had to be calmed by celebrity pals saying, cool it, big boy, because if you call Richard Hammond big, he tends to calm down, which I really liked.
I would also love to know what Coogan's relationship with Richard Hammond and Nick Knowles is. Like, if they ever see each other at kind of awards dues, is it a quick, you know, laugh and a joke about this, or, you know, how they kind of perceive these in real life?
I mean, Coogan's done the Star in a Reasonably Priced Car on Top Gear while Hammond was presenting it, I believe. So they must have interacted at the very least.
Yeah, true.
Did anyone note down where he solicited the questions for this AMA? Some of them traditional, some of them less so. So he's asked for them on Twitter, Facebook, his local paper, and people he's close to.
Well, I was going to say, my note is, in essence, he's kind of sourced this via any correspondence he's had across his life in the past week. Like meeting a dog walker saying, do you like dogs? he almost includes that as one.
Also interesting that he says that questions have come from every corner of the UK, ignoring the fact that if you solicited on Twitter and Facebook, you would expect at least some international ones.
Just a couple of quick pronunciation things I spotted before we get into the questions as well. Did you guys make a note that he says tangential instead of tangential?
No, but that's great.
And merely minutes after saying that nobody pronounces AMA armour, he calls it armour.
Oh, brilliant. I didn't spot that.
Yeah, that happens just before he gets into the Nick Knowles bit, I think.
Excellent.
Wonderful.
Is it time to tackle the first of these meaty questions?
Yes, let's.
I mean, it's how would you deal with terrorists, which is an odd question, but if you park that, it's probably something that would elicit a fairly detailed and, dare I say, robust response. But no, we don't get that.
Don't you think as well that if someone asks how would you deal with terrorists, they're probably talking on a sort of wider socio-political, you know, is it sanctions? Is it Guantanamo? Do you believe that torture is justified, you know, kind of on a sort of country versus country level, whereas he is talking very much about how you would deal with a terrorist if you met them in an Iceland car park, for example.
Well, he's basically putting himself into his own Die Hard movie, isn't he? That's what he's doing.
Yeah, so his answer is that he would kick them so hard in the balls that they would collapse. It's very obvious that all of the tips that he's got here for dealing with terrorists have been taken from films where Hollywood actors deal with terrorists. I particularly like that this segues into a little bit of chat about Tom Cruise, where he says Tom Cruise exercises a lot because he can't form human relationships unless, of course, it's with Simon Pegg. But he really muffles the word Simon Pegg as if he's sort of trying to say it but not say it at the same time.
So I think, is that a thing where that's just because obviously Coogan and Pegg have worked together loads over the years, is that just for him that's a bit of fun just to put a dig in for Pegg, like as a mate essentially, like
going, yeah, I think it's, yeah,
mates for Tom Cruise, yeah.
We know anecdotally that they are mates, they spent New Year's Eve together at some point in the past, but I think it's just a little dig at him because obviously now he's super Mr. Big Hollywood.
Exactly.
And I think that's always kind of what Coogan wants, to be super big A-list Hollywood in Hollywood, and he's not quite that. But Simon Pegg very much is now.
Just to be clear, it's Tom Stab saying he's not quite that. We haven't. It's not the rest of us saying that. Tom Stab there.
I think the thing that I enjoy is whenever Simon Pegg is over for Mission Impossible promo, is that he's almost become the mouthpiece for Tom Cruise, because Cruise doesn't do tons of promo. And so Simon Pegg will often just get asked all of these kind of Tom Cruise conduit questions. And it's just funny kind of hearing him kind of almost be the mouthpiece for Tom. So yeah, I did enjoy that. It was good.
Has he ever tried to convert you to Scientology, that sort of thing?
I feel as well. Yeah. It's like, if someone offered you money to name a friend of Tom Cruise after Simon Pegg, it would be quite hard to name another person. So I think they have got a bit of a point there. So Alan has to stop Oosthuis the episode very briefly to deal with a walker wearing trainers, he's keen to point out, so not prepared for the terrain, who should have permission before walking on his permissive footpath. And he then goes on to talk about the fact that he once met a pro hunter working for the Real Countryside Alliance, which I like because it's a nice alignment with the IRA and the real IRA, the idea that there needs to be like a militant sub-wing of the Countryside Alliance.
I think that was or is a real thing, the Real Countryside Alliance.
Oh, really?
I don't think it's something they've just made up for that.
Hilarious.
I was going to say, is it fair to assume that ramblers walking through probably happens almost daily to Alan living in the Oosthuis and he hates it?
Yeah, absolutely.
I think that's what we kind of led to there.
Yeah.
And I thought there's a nice little tie-in with Sir Cecil Phillips, the leader of the annual North Norfolk hunt from Mid-Morning Matters as well. Because remember when Alan had him on as a guest, he basically had to face angry calls afterwards because he didn't challenge any of Cecil's views on fox hunting. So it seems like he's still taking whatever people involved in hunts and things, he's just taking whatever they tell him at face value. Yeah, he's never questioning what they think is right.
Although he does display some scepticism, because he says the pro hunter explained that huntsmen are basically filling in for an absent wolf population, but Alan observes that he also had an answer for everything.
Yeah, I think it's quite a nice subtle bit of writing that's essentially having a slight dig at the hunting community, that you know, you have to get dressed up with all this pageantry to ultimately murder a small brown dog. They're not dogs.
Crucial to note that we are halfway through this episode and one question has been asked so far in the Ask Me Anything episode of the Oosthuis.
The bit when Alan's talking about people being unfamiliar with the rambling protocol, going for country wearing trainers, have we all been guilty of that at times, do we think? Having ill-prepared footwear choices for countryside walks?
I've certainly drenched a skate shoe in my time, yeah.
Because I have in my mind that I once had a walk around Richmond Park with some pals, including Nick, and I'm pretty sure it was very muddy and Nick was wearing brand new bright white Converse.
Oh, yeah, probably. That sounds like me.
Yeah, it seems like you, doesn't it?
I don't remember it, but I'm not going to challenge it because that sounds plausible.
Seems like it's also a thing Nick would do.
There's a nice bit of observational comedy, I guess, that relates to footwear. He says, when you see a boot scraper outside someone's house, you think they know how to vote in a general election, which is kind of like, you obviously don't agree with that point, but you can really see what he means, can't you?
Yeah, and I did check, with the exception of Norwich South, the whole Norfolk and Suffolk area did vote Tory in the 2019 general election.
Mm-hmm.
Just had to check that.
The next question comes in from Hayley, who asks, to whom would you like to apologise? Alan's got a very specific answer for this one.
Yeah, and again, it would be an opportunity to hear an interesting response in terms of the people that maybe he's slighted or upset, or, you know, with the joy of hindsight, you can look back on and think, actually, probably I would like to apologise to that person because I said the wrong thing, I overstepped the mark, whatever it might be. What we get is as ludicrous an answer as kicking terrorists in the bollocks.
Before we get into the detail of that as well, I really like the fact he starts off his answer by saying, I'm not much of an apologiser, but 30 seconds previous, he was apologising to the hunting community for saying they wear leggings, not jumpers.
And of course, something that, you know, you can imagine Alan saying or thinking without actually hearing it in this episode, he sees willingness to apologise as a weakness rather than a sign of strength and humility.
Yeah. And so just to be clear, this kind of story boils down to he was on a plane, someone was telling Alan about his job, and he thought it sounded a bit boring, so he pretended to go to sleep, which isn't great, but I think where it gets really bad is he then kind of, you know, partially opens his eye to see if the chap is still looking at and talking to him, which it transpires that he is, and understandably the chap's obviously a little bit miffed for that. That in and of itself is bad and funny, but there are two additional payoffs to this, which are great. So one is Alan's yawn. I don't know if anyone's prepared to do an impression of how Alan pretends to yawn.
Yeah, that's pretty good, actually, yeah.
But that's brilliant. Then it's also the payoff where Alan says he's sorry. Then there's a tactical pause where it's like, if he felt offended by my fake sleep.
Yep.
So it's an apology for if that chap felt bad for Alan pretending to sleep. It's not an apology.
On a flight, which happened in 1990. He's learned a thing or two from kind of celebrities and politicians apologising, but not really, hasn't he?
It's the classic kind of era of social media apology. I'm sorry if you were offended. It's very, very, very backhanded.
The next question comes from Twitter, and it is literally, where get shoes?
So, Alan, where get shoes?
Isn't that from this time?
Yeah, it is.
Yes, it's used to this time, episode it? Two.
There does always tend to be a sort of a 3% crossover from one Partridge Project to the next in terms of gags, doesn't there? A couple of recycled. He lists
and
all
that
his shoes.
That tweet does still exist as well. That is still... Because when we worked out that they'd taken real tweets to At This Time Show, so you can find that, Alan Where Get Shoes. And I really enjoyed Alan's keeping a list of funny place names. The one that stuck out most for me was Barton in the Beans. That did genuinely quite amuse me. I did have a quick look into that for anything interesting. It's a hamlet in Leicestershire, and I think Lynn would probably like it because Wikipedia tells me there are no shops or pubs here, only a Baptist church and a postbox.
So in the interest of Alan keeping a list of funny place names, I took to Google and I've come up with a list of funny place names, and I want you to tell me whether they are real place names or whether I have made them up.
It's realing them or faking them, part two.
It is. Yep. We've essentially done this game before, but why not do it again? Why not just rehash it? Sure. Anyway, right, so group consensus. I've got 10 names. I'll rattle through them quite quickly, and I want a group consensus. Do you think they're real or are they fake? Right, so number one, gaping hole.
God. Real.
Real.
Oh, okay, I've been outvoted. Fine, we're saying real.
It's fake.
I was going to say, guys, gaping hole, come on.
Number two. Boggy bottom.
Yes, real. I think, yeah, that's, I'm going to say real.
Okay, real.
It is real. It's in Hertfordshire. Number three, happy bottom.
I think it's fake. Fake. Happy bottom.
It's real. It's in Dorset.
Nick.
Number four, scratchy bottom.
Got to be.
Are these all going to be variations on bottom?
No, this is the last bottom related one.
Okay.
Real?
I'm going to say fake for scratchy.
Yeah, I think fake.
Scratchy bottom is in Dorset.
Oh, script, script, script.
Next up, sandy balls.
Why the balls? Why the balls? Like, at the bottom makes sense, but balls is not a...
So you're saying fake?
I think fake.
I'm fake. Yeah. I'm saying fake.
It's in Hampshire, it's real. Next one.
Nick, I think what we're learning here is there's no point in applying logic to why these places have these names.
True.
Next one. Reach around.
Fake.
Fake. Fake. Come on, surely. Fake.
It is fake.
Yeah.
Next one. Twat.
Oh, that's true, I think. I think that's real.
I think that's real, and I'm going to say it's got two T's at the end.
Okay.
Real.
It is real and has two T's at the end. It's in the Orkney Isles. Next one, great balls.
I mean, after sandy balls, anything's possible, right? So should we say
yeah. If they can be sandy, they can certainly be great. Yeah.
Oh, but is Stab trying to catch us out? Is this fake?
I'm going to say real.
I'm going to say real as well.
Okay, group consensus.
It's fake.
Oh.
Penultimate one. Great Fanny Cove.
Yeah, gotta be real.
I'm happy to say real.
Yep, sure, real.
I made that one up, it's fake.
Oh, we are bad at this.
And finally, Wet Wang.
Real. That is real.
Oh, okay. Tom Dark knows. He's been to Wet Wang.
Good knowledge of a Wet Wang. It's Tom Dark.
Wet Wang is indeed real. It's in Yorkshire.
Wow, we did terribly.
There we go.
That.
That's the end of the quiz. I wasn't counting what ones you were getting right. It seems you did quite badly.
Yeah.
I think we can all agree.
We're happy to have not kept score. Paul from Throop emails to ask who should be the next James Bond. Alan, of course, is overflowing with opinions and ideas on this. Claims he'd be fine with a female Bond because he's not sure you can be that prickly about casting the role of a quintessential Englishman when you've already given it to a Scottish chap. which is nice because I feel like we discussed this before on the dating episode, him going full Lazenby and being a big fan of Lazenby's Bond, that Alan basically likes the Bonds that no one else does. So he doesn't rate Connery, but he is a big fan of Lazenby.
Also, Lazenby is Australian.
Okay, of course.
Yeah,
there
he is. He is. You're quite
right. I also did enjoy with the idea that we'll get into that he's saying, yes, he would make it a woman, but then goes on to describe at great length his idea starring two men.
Yes. So let's get into Alan's grand Bond concept. You can tell he's had time to develop this over several years. He would split James Bond into two characters.
Can I say something? Sorry to cut you off, but there's a line that he says about this idea that I think before we go in to describe it, I think it's worth pulling this line out. So he says, the reason the idea works is because you have to obey the rule of logic. Now, remember that as we go on to describe this idea, the rule of logic.
Yeah, fair point. So, it's worth having that at the top.
Please continue, Adam.
He would split James Bond into two characters, Jack James, played by Idris Elba, and Brian Bond, played by Tom Hiddleston. They would form a detective agency. At this point, I realise he's also drawing on his limited knowledge of Holmes and Watson.
Yeah, exactly.
One of his specialist subjects, he claimed, but he didn't know that Sherlock Holmes wasn't real. Let's remember that. He claims they need to be two of them so that they can infiltrate different types of areas. This is where his casual racism comes in as well, because he claims that Idris Elba would be given short shrift at a private members club for old Etonians. The first movie, it gets worse.
Oh, hang on, but before we get into that, I just really enjoyed that you couldn't imagine Hiddleston genuinely having a fight with someone or being good at running.
Yeah, that's why you need two actors. The first movie would be Firewall, License to Kill Malware, a mission that takes place inside the internet. He then goes into a very complicated bit about how he believes that firstly, he talks again about the importance of it has to follow the logic of the internet. Then explaining that's why they would need to be physically shrunk and put on a USB stick so that they can have a physical fight with a computer virus. Basically, he's clearly watched the movie Inner Space in the last few weeks.
Yes, exactly that. They're no bigger than ants, and the virus looks like stormtroopers. There's a couple of key details for the plot there as well.
Yeah, so that's Alan's logical layout of how Bond, the future of Bond should look.
Just very quickly, though, I'd like to put an appeal out to the listeners. If they could send in their mock-up posters of James and Bond in Firewall, License to Kill Malware, that'd be something a bit of fun to share on the socials, I reckon. Because we had some good... Oh, fuck, I can't remember. What were the posters we had in before? Oh, Skirmish, the movie, wasn't it?
And also, we also had people's submissions for Nick being eaten by Quaddy as well.
Oh, yes, yeah, and John Baskill in Ghost as well. Any mock-up posters for James and Bond in Firewall, License to Kill Malware, please do send them over.
I don't think License to Kill Malware is the title. I think that's the tagline. It's James and Bond in Firewall. And then the tagline License to Kill Malware.
Leave that up to the listener's interpretation. Yeah.
I thought it was a sort of Mission Impossible Ghost Protocol situation where it's part of the title, it's on the other side of a colon. Anyway, up to your interpretation.
Very clear.
The next question he's asked is, where are you going on holiday? He says he aimed originally to spend 6 months traversing Africa diagonally in a Land Rover. But an expert said he wasn't experienced enough, so he's going for a fortnight in the Peak District to lots and lots of zip wiring at Go Ape.
Yeah. And Guardian readers might not understand it, but deep down, they also want to do it.
Yep. There's a segment here where he's like, it's a special new segment with its own theme, Me Facts. And that fact is
facts
that he's never
me.
Been to Northern Ireland. And that's the whole segment, beginning to end. He's just never been to Northern Ireland.
That's very kind of GCSE My First Podcast. It's utterly pointless. I think the jingle in and out of the fact is longer than the fact itself. But also, I think the great thing, it's a great connection back to I'm Alan Partridge Series 1. He still hasn't visited Northern Ireland. In 1997, he said he'd love to go, but to be fair, he was put off by the prices of the £49 flights.
That's Ireland, not Northern Ireland, in I'm Alan Partridge Series 1.
But don't worry, Tom, because historically there's been no problem with intimating that Ireland and Northern Ireland are effectively the same thing.
I think the point still stands.
So Alan's that's not Tom going Dark there. Confusing Northern Ireland and Ireland as the same thing. That's Tom Dark.
Who?
Oh dear. Right, should we move on?
Yes, so there's a number of, this is quite a simple gag, but I really enjoyed it. There's a number of questions that have been collated by Lynn that have been posted in, I believe, such as, has he been involved in an accident that wasn't his fault? Would he like to earn pounds at home? Is he thinking of moving house? And have you registered to vote?
I'm a big fan of Alan just kind of saying under his breath, Jesus Christ, she's shit.
Yeah,
and then calling her Glynn.
Yeah,
I missed that.
I missed that.
He goes, "Christ, she's shit," and then just says, "Glynn."
So he has to resort to asking whoever's around for questions. So it's another appearance from his cleaner, Rosa, who's fast becoming a fan favourite in this series. He says, "Rosa, have you got any question for me?" She asks him for more money. He's like, "No, a question about me." And then she just goes, "No, thank you."
Oh, that is so good.
Is this the point where High Noon makes another appearance to thwart Alan and frankly Riley Marks?
Yes. Yep.
Yeah.
With a barrage of questions.
Yeah, has anyone got those questions? I think I've got them if not. I mean, there is.
Go ahead.
There is a lot, but it's how many wing mirrors have you hit with your car recently? Why do you iron a crease into your trousers when no one else does? Why do you wash your own car? This is the one I enjoyed the most. Why do you have a different hairstyle when Pat Farrell went mad with a gun at North Norfolk Digital in 2013? Which I feel is essentially questions that they were probably bombarded with from either, like, you know, people on Twitter, social media, or just in the press in general. So it's a nice opportunity to kind of surface that one.
It's absolutely the writers using the character as the mouthpiece again, isn't it? And because they also reference that specifically in Nomad. When Alan writes in Nomad, quoting people, "I don't understand why your hair is like that," people would say, "like it even frigging mattered. You don't even look like Alan anymore. Why is it like that? That's not Alan. Alan's is shorter. Why have you made it long at the back? It shouldn't be long. Alan has short hair." So, yeah, they're just doubling down on that.
Yeah.
Another question from High Noon is, do you still park in disabled parking spaces at the supermarket? Now, over the years, we know Alan's had a lot of issues with disabled parking spaces and the amount of them and the rights of who gets to use them. He claims that on this occasion, he was in and out, although it does transpire he was shopping for 45 minutes. And his further justification is that it was on a Sunday and disabled people don't shop on Sundays. Where his logic comes from.
Yeah, that's low even for Alan, isn't it? I mean, that's just indefensible.
And there's a bit of an indication that High Noon is potentially a bit of a stalker, I would think, from these questions as well. You've got the thing about why do you smell of E45 cream to the people that sit beside you on the train, as well as the do you still park in disabled parking spaces?
Yeah, slightly worrying. Sinister. I mean, perhaps a sort of a Jed Maxwell 2.0 in the making.
Yeah, should we get into the overly detailed nuance of the Norfolk accent?
Yes, I mean, don't you feel like this is a little bit like the justification for him having a different haircut in Alpha Papa, and like the section in I Partridge about how he lost his nasality? It's another one of those questions where fans are like, well, if he's supposed to be from Norfolk, why does he sound like he's not? And this is them addressing that.
But the weird thing about that, he's never sounded like he's come from Norfolk, has he? But it's that thing that, as we've talked about before, that, you know, he started out and it was very much to kind of John Motson-esque accent, and that has gradually kind of reduced. And yeah, like, you know, those kind of sports reader tones of the early 90s are long gone. But arguably, alongside that, the voice of Coogan and Partridge, they're virtually indistinguishable now. I think when I've been listening to a few of these episodes, like, other people that might have heard some have said, well, it's basically like he just sounds like Coogan now.
Mm. Yeah, they kind of like suddenly merged into one super being.
I would say that this is a really, really strong episode. I really liked it. There's a lot of good stuff here, as we've gone through. But this is a bit of a weak ending, because I think I like the gag, but I think it just goes on a little bit too long.
I actually could not disagree with you more, because I think that they've had form in this area of getting overly detailed on things that sometimes can't be that funny. And I thought, you know, something like iPartridge, where they talked about DAB and the details of DAB radio, and I thought, oh, that just went on for too long. I think that this is detailed enough, but also not so long that it became boring. And I thought that the Bernard Matthews payoff at the end was really strong. So I thought that,
that was good.
Well observed.
What, the angel of death for turkeys?
yeah, exactly. So yeah, detailed enough, but not too long, and with a strong payoff. So yeah, I thought it worked. I personally thought it worked well and was very funny.
I thought the payoff was good. I did enjoy it, and I also did enjoy the bit where Alan does an impersonation of a Norfolk accent as well. That is funny, but I just think it just went on a little bit too long for me. But yeah, in general, a very strong episode, I still think.
I think they're very good at conjuring up images of celebrities that have got a very well-defined public persona and then messing around with that. So even in a previous episode where he's sort of making childish, he makes childish accusations about celebrities. And then here, if you've ever seen a Bernard Matthews advert, you imagine him as a very larger-than-life character, sort of very brash, very full of confidence. So the idea that he's actually very self-conscious and says beautiful in the turkey ads just because he can't get rid of his accent, and it's like a real bugbear for him, rather than the reality, which is that, you know, he's obviously Yorkshire and proud and making it, Norfolk and proud, sorry, and making it a real feature of the adverts.
That's Adam Brooks conflating Yorkshire with Norfolk there. Adam Brooks.
Yeah. What I also enjoy is that Bernard Matthews was obviously one a business owner, but you know, there are those kind of instances where the owner of the company is put at the forefront in the advertising. And we spoke earlier in this episode about how Lynn has had her kind of, you know, illusion shattered about how Mr. Kipling isn't a real person. She probably thinks the man from Del Monte, you know, actually existed, and that Aunt Bessie slaves over a hot stove to get her Yorkshire puddings and roast potatoes out. But this is a nice example of, you know, Bernard Matthews is actually a real person. But I wonder if Alan at any point tried to suggest otherwise, or Lynn probably had her kind of conjuring of these characters off the back of Bernard Matthews, who was one of the first of these kind of, you know, real people being the face of a business.
There's a lovely bit as well where Alan implies that some of Bernard's meat, rather than containing chicken or turkey, just contained generic food fowl.
I did also enjoy, I did take to YouTube to watch a couple of the classic Bernard Matthews adverts, and they do often talk about how it's kind of turkey meat with a kind of like pork fat outside. So it is the kind of like melding of two meats that didn't sound great, to be honest.
Just mashed into a generic shape.
Yeah.
Into a puck.
Yeah, back in the 80s when that was a delicious novelty rather than a horrendous nightmare. So I think that turkey bombshell brings us more or less to the end of the Ask Me Anything episode, where I feel like Alan's been asked a very small amount of questions, and most of them seem to be from one person or from junk mail.
Well, I think if you break it down, he's answered successfully six questions in the whole AMA there, which is: how would you deal with terrorists? To whom would you like to apologise? Alan, where get shoes? Who do you think should be the next James Bond? Would you make it a woman? Where are you going on holiday? And why do you drop your Norwich accent if you're so proud of being from Norfolk?
So yeah, I guess it's not a bad hit rate. I would personally have liked a follow-up episode where he answers more questions.
Well, I guess to be fair, it's a 22-minute episode. The fact he's actually even answered six, I was quite surprised he got through that many. I thought the joke would be he might answer one or none.
Especially at the halfway mark, he had only answered one.
Yeah.
Fair play to him. I think these are a couple of really good, fun episodes. Pretty well structured, very funny. What I always love is a good bit of insight into the background life and the character. I think I've mentioned it on the pod before, but there was a series of Peep Show that was recorded so that the six episodes could be broadcast in any order. And as soon as I found that out, I was really disappointed, because what I like is the narrative building. So there's plenty of that here, and I really, really enjoy that, especially the visit to Lynn's house.
Yeah, I guess because, as we've said, without giving too much away about what transpires across the series, the one kind of core narrative element is about this High Noon character. So in episode one, when he's talking about High Noon and his online trolls, you don't really get any detail or insight into what kind of trolling is actually happening. So this is the first instance like where you get those list of questions, where you start to get a bit more detail about like how Alan feels he's being attacked online.
Yeah, and hopefully there will be more of that to come. we'll be back next week tackling more of the Partridge universe, more Tales from the Oast House. And if you'd like to get in touch with us about your thoughts, theories, or questions about this series, on Instagram we're at Monkey Tennis Pod. On Twitter we're at The Partridge Pod. We're on facebook.com/thepartridgepod, thepartridgepod@gmail.com, and you can leave us a voice note through WhatsApp on the Monkey Tennis Hotline 07923 600 017.
And as we mentioned at the top of the episode, this is episode 100, a big milestone. So if you have been enjoying our content and our output over the last 4 years, I think it is, and you haven't dropped us a review on iTunes, Apple Podcasts, please feel free to do so. 5 stars. I think like the way that it works is you have to put in 5 stars, I think. Like,
that's, yeah, I think the one that's right. To, yeah.
So leave us a rating and a review. We would really appreciate it if you've been enjoying our output over the last 100 episodes.
If you're having Partridge problems, I feel bad for you, son. We've done 99 episodes and also this one. From all of us at Monkey Tennis, the Alan Partridge Fan Podcast, thanks for listening and goodbye.
Goodbye. I'm off for a bath.
And this is the beauty of podcasting, the freedom of the medium.
Kukumpa.
Monkey tennis?
Bring, bring.
Fireworks. Don't muck about.
Trees are my pawn.
Monkey tennis?
Ready, steady, fuck off.
Scratch me!
Are you being served?
Monkey tennis?
Excuse me, your dog's taken my dog's stick.
With a chuckle, with a chuckle.
Monkey tennis?
Absolutely, absolutely.
Generally, I think new ideas are bad.
Monkey tennis?
Why not consider chips?
You must come and stay in the barn. Fuck off.
Riddle me that, you nutters. Nothing refreshes like an ice-cold glass of milk. Nah.
Monkey tennis?
From the Oast House.
Keep it down, love.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.